philosophers in
space.
What happened to your eyes?
Where am I going? We won't need eyes to see.
Where are they?
I don't know, sir. They must have hyperjets on that thing.
And what do we got on this thing? A Cuisinart?
No, sir.
We'll find them, catch them.
Would like to ask a question.
What is it?
Will I dream?
Brain bugs? Frankly, I find the idea of a bug that thinks offensive.
In space. This is episode 70. I'm Thomas. That over there is Aaron. And we are joined by Hannah, who will zap us if we say anything wrong in this, anything untowards, if we do any too much mansplaining. What's the right amount of mansplaining? Like to 1% or 0%? We'll say 0%. How's it going, Hannah?
Yes, it's good. Thank you. I was just thinking about what the right amount of mansplaining was and I got distracted.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I think it's maybe like 0.5%, so I can feel superior when I point it out.
Yeah, that's there you go. I like that. She's everything Jordan Peterson warned us about. She's a postmodernist. She confessed to being deeply postmodernist, which I'm sure will come into play in this episode. We are going to be talking about the power still. This is part two, and I think there will be a little less exposition in this one since we covered most of it in the first episode, and that gives us the opportunity to really dig into some more philosophy. But, you know, I did want to bring up there's like a specific scene in the book that I think will maybe work as exposition for some of the discussion for part two. So if you guys don't mind, I was thinking maybe I could do a little mini exposition here. A very, very mini. So Brian can just play the exposition music, but like at, you know, 5x speed. And it's just like, you know, that kind of thing. One scene that just really stuck with me from, you know, it's been like I said, over a year since I read this, but it really stuck with me was when it's kind of in the intermediate period, you know, where they're still figuring out this power and they're still, society is still coping with it, you know, and men are still kind of in charge of things, you know, but it's, they're losing their grip on power. And there's a scene, and I want to say, I think it's Margot who is the politician.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it's a scene where like she has to answer to somebody, like, you know, there's some angry boss man that is like, you know, she's constantly answering to. And there's a scene where, and it's also a little bit important that she has had to keep her power a secret because they're in this kind of transition period. Everybody's really afraid of the power and they're trying to find ways to get rid of it. They're trying to find ways to, like, you know, which we didn't really talk about a whole lot in the first part. There's all these little, there's like these kind of re-education camps. There's things that men are trying to do and society is trying to do to grapple with this change. And one of them is to try to, like, you know, find ways to repress this electrical shock power that all these young women have, because as Hannah covered, it appears in young women, but it can also be awakened in older women. And Margot, I believe, is the character, right, that has the power, but she's kind of hiding it because, so she doesn't want to be outed because in her position of authority, in her political position, she needs to hide it to kind of still, like, so people aren't too afraid of her kind of thing. But there's a scene where she is, you know, kind of getting chewed out by the old man boss, you know, that has been in charge for so long. And there's this internal monologue that happens where she just gets up and leaves. Like, she's just like, he's in the middle of like, oh, how dare you, whatever, you know, like a lecture kind of thing. And she's just like, eh, I'm going to just leave. And I love it because it, in her thought process, it's like, you know, I'm not going to kill this man with my shock, you know, electricity power, but like I could just stop his, you know, his blathering right now. I could just shock him right now. And it gives her this power that, you know, like, I think is at play in everyday situations with men and women often, even though it's, you know, it's all implicit and it's, well, maybe not all implicit, but it's not as though in like an office situation, I'm going to like ever hurt anybody. But there's this thing that we all know, there's this power that men in our society have usually on statistically on average, which is a physical ability to over like to overpower any woman. And it's like it comes into play in so many little ways, you know, that maybe we aren't conscious of. And I just love this scene because she just gets up and walks. It's like, I don't really care what, like, there's no, you know, there's no threat that this man is to me anymore. Like, there's no reason, there's nothing, there's no force that keeps me in this room anymore. And I just thought it was so powerful and interesting. So
yeah,
should we use that to talk about gender essentialism?
Yeah, no, I was something like just giving Hannah a little space there. I didn't wanna...
Sure.
Yes, sorry, I was just thinking, but you guys go ahead and then I'll jump in on the...
Yeah, so I think that's a really good example of the kind of question that I wanted to dive into this episode about the relationships between the power dominance stuff that we've talked about a little bit and what this book has to say on gender. And I mean, I guess I'm curious a little bit, since we've talked a little bit about how people see, read this book differently from differing perspectives. What do y'all think are the morals of this story, or a moral of this story with regard to these big questions?
See, I think that's kind of the tricky thing. And I think that a lot of the people I've found who have responded poorly to this book are ones who've tried to take a kind of straight moral mm-hmm. from it and kind of tried to go, well, it's saying, you know, women should take over the world and be super aggressive and an eye for an eye and that kind of sort of quite mm-hmm. linear reading of it. And I think... I kind of think it doesn't have a moral. Like, I think it's basically saying all of this is super messy. And I guess it's trying to say that the structures that we exist in might be more fragile than people think they are, and sort of how you push them. Like, you know, if something changed, it would change things more than you might realize, because maybe there isn't this essential nature, or maybe there isn't this sort of... So it's... But I also think it can be read on, mm-hmm. because I've read reviews of people going, oh, I hadn't realized until I read this that, like, this is how men treat women at the moment.
Right.
So, like, at its most simplistic level, you could, I mean, no, simplistic is not.
I know, I love that. I was just going to say, Hannah, like, I think you're coming at this from an extremely sophisticated angle. And, like, if I were to answer the basic moral of what this is about, it's like, I think the implicit use of force has a lot of effect on the, like, relationships between men and women. And you're like, well, that's stupid. That's the obvious thing. But, like, I think it really depends on who's reading it. You know, there are people who are, you know, have just not... If you were reading this and you were someone who has not thought a lot about, I don't know, feminism or, like, gender in our society, which, you know, that's a lot of people. You know, we're sometimes in a very specific bubble, I think. And I'm not going to include myself in your bubble, but I'm in a bubble, you're in a bubble, we're all in a bubble. But, like, that's, I think it's a very powerful and basic message there, which is what does this statistically significant ability that, you know, men have had throughout history, or whatever, the characteristic that men have had throughout history, to be able to physically overpower women, what has that done to our relationships and how has it functioned? And I think it's a really powerful, almost a thought experiment in a book in some ways. Now, there's a lot more to it, of course, but, like, I think that's a very powerful, simplistic or simple version of what's happening in the book, personally.
Yeah. Yeah, I think probably simple but not simplistic is the,
yeah.
the fair way of talking about it. And I guess it is interesting to think about the bubbles that we're in affecting mm-hmm. how we read it. Yeah, that's it. I think it does have that powerful message, but I just think it has the ability to contain so much more than that. And I think, you know, the popularity of The Handmaid's Tale and the sort of resurgence of the popularity with the TV show, which is, and, you know, that is, you know, in many ways the direct precursor to this book, sort of does show that, like, a lot of people are gaining the capacity to think through these issues on, like, lots of different levels, and also, like, you know, who is actually picking up the power, I think is an interesting, you know, are most of its readers people who have already engaged with The Handmaid's Tale on some level? Because then actually, you know, you're not new to this question of the kind of violence that men can impart upon mm-hmm. women. So it's interesting, I guess, thinking about it in the literary context I guess. But then also I think the fact that it's a very, you know, it's a very sophisticated sort of web of theory, but in a really readable sort of novelistic dystopian page turning sort of, I think it calls it a globe trotting, thrill seeking page turning thing on the globe and like on the blurb. And it, you know, it is. So actually what can be derived from it beyond that kind of basic story is really interesting as well.
Yeah, I mean, I want to try to like press on its philosophy a little bit. And maybe, I mean, again, we should caveat everything we say in this is, you know, from my perspective with my particular experiences and my interests, right? I read into it a lot of anti-gender essentialism. But I mean, I think the interesting thing of what we talked about in the first part with the meta framing devices makes it hard to know which of the actual claims about gender is the one that maybe we're supposed to agree with or believe. So let me, if I could, I want to quote one piece originally. Then this is Neil talking to Naomi at the end in their back and forth letters. He says, gender is a shell game, right? What is man? Whatever a woman isn't. What is a woman? Whatever a man is not. Tap on it and it's hollow. Look under the shell and it's not there. Do you think that we're meant to, that we should agree with that? Or is that meant to be like, from Neil's naive perspective, and maybe there is something still true to gender? What do y'all think about that quote?
It's interesting because I think like that's sort of, I guess, almost what I think. And you know, we're in a space where a lot of people are talking about performances of gender and sort of what is to, you know, exhibit feminine traits versus what to be, what it is to be a woman. But then simultaneously, so much of the content of the book itself is about like the physicality of these schemes embedded on women's bodies and that being like an essential part of womanhood. And it sort of feels like the book is trying to play out that tension between the two things, because again, I've spoken to people who have gone, right, there's a problematic level of gender essentialism in the book in the way that it embeds this kind of new form of femininity onto women's bodies. And it almost, you could almost see it as a enaction of the battle between sort of second wave feminism and, you know, I am woman, see me kind of bleed upon the floor, and fourth wave, well, we're all just constructing our gender thing that's happening at the moment, sort of embodied in the two poles of the book.
That's exactly right. And I was thinking specifically the character Jocelyn, who has, because of her inability to consistently have her power, is sort of exemplifies like someone who's stuck between the gender binary and like how damaging that binary can be for them. And a lot of the cyborg theory, it seemed like, is about the rejection of these various kinds of harmful binaries.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Although, you know, with what happens with Jocelyn, you then get into sort of tricky questions of, you know, what is that meant to be a metaphor for in our society? And
I'm blanking on what happened to Jocelyn. Why don't you, does somebody want to do some exposition on that if we're going to talk about it for our readers and me, our listeners rather, and me?
Jocelyn is the daughter of Margot, the senator, I think she is, who gets the power, but it's intermittent. And like, she has that one really rough scene where she fights a guy and her power isn't fully reliable. And like, she's, her character is kind of defined by who she's supposed to be in light of not being as consistently powerful as all the other people. There's, she has a couple of really wonderful scenes. And I think she sort of plays up how hard, like, how even when the binary is inverted through this different essentialist feature, and I totally agree with Hannah that like it is a tension, that it is a kind of biological essentialism, that she is another part of a group of people who are left out as a result.
Yeah, absolutely. And but then it's very interesting that she ends up, you know, she kind of ends up resorting to drugs to try and, you know, regulate her power, and ends up kind of accidentally killing someone, and then is lauded as a hero. And there's sort of, the narrative is spun, which sort of brings us back to this question of, you know, what even is truth.
Yeah. And the,
what even is anything? That's where we always come back to.
There is the, and like, because this is a philosophy show, right? We should do some philosophy things in this. There's this part at the end that we haven't talked about that is another level of framing device. The Apocrypha excluded from the Book of Eve. It's described as discovered in a cave in Cappadocia about 1,500 years ago. Mm. And it's a little bit of sort of religious sounding kind of writing from someone. And at the end of it, I'm just going to read the part at the end that I think relates to this topic. It says, even a stone is not the same as any other stone. There is no shape to anything except the shape it has. Every name we give ourselves is wrong.
Mm.
And that, to me, harkens to, like, sort of Taoist statements about, like, the Tao that can be named is not the eternal Tao, which is the idea that, like, our mind's attempts to frame the world in genders, in dynamics, are always flawed attempts to carve up a world that is much more complex than we can make it.
Mm.
I mean, I wonder what you think, like, the fact that that's an apocrypha from the Book of Eve rather than something that is put in the mouth of Neil or in the mouth of Naomi, if that might mean that that's a section that is sort of given a kind of epistemic privilege amongst the issues of epistemic uncertainty in this book. Are we meant to sort of see that claim as being a little closer to the true intent? What do you think? Mm.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, the way that in a kind of flipped postmodern narrative, the Apocrypha is the thing that feels more true because it's purposefully excluded.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, I think you can definitely take that to be, well, that's what, because Eve's goal was to sort of start society again from scratch with this new template, any kind of sense of something that would question this new reality that she's bringing about would be something that she'd want to exclude. But then as soon as you start thinking in these splits, you then have to go, well, does the fact that she would want to exclude it actually make it any more true than her position? Or is it just that it's an opposing position to the one that she would want to pull forward? I think there's something interesting about kind of the privileged position of Apocrypha to play with. I mean, I heard the other day that there's a whole set of Apocrypha in which Eve is the hero of the, as in, sorry, like Lilith. In real life, in which Eve is
doing some like role playing of the power world, like
in which she's the hero of the kind of apple scene, and she sort of brings knowledge to humanity in that scene of a good thing. And if the people who believe that had won the knowledge wars, then maybe we would have a very different structure of society at this point. So
I think Lilith comes up in the Apocrypha as well, in the same kind of as the first wife of Adam. It's, some people will argue, who refused to be subservient to Adam and so is cast out of the garden. And that, like, going back to the apple metaphor that I failed to fully understand initially, right? Because I was obsessed with this other side of it, where it's like, you also have the golden apple with the goddess Eris or Discord, and the idea that sort of women represent temptation or chaos, but that it also could represent bounty and life and all of these affirming kinds of things. And it becomes about, you know, who has control of the framing device around the symbolism.
Mm. Yeah, although actually I was just in Disobedience, which is Naomi Alderman's first book. She quotes a biblical story, and I don't actually know if it's true. I should probably find out. But it's a story about how the sun and the moon were created equal at first, and then the moon complained and said one of us should be in charge. And then God said, okay, cool. In that case, the sun's going to be in charge, and you are going to be sort of an eighth of its light because you complained, you're going to get what you want, but be careful what you wish for. But then you get all the stars as your friends as a sort of compensatory thing. And she was playing with it, with this idea of sort of and then the moon represents women in this particular metaphor, in case that wasn't super clear. And so there's this sub bit about kind of female community and sort of leaning on each other, but also this idea of, I guess, the potential for equality being inherent even in this sort of traditional patriarchal religion. And of course, Naomi Alderman was brought up incredibly Orthodox Jewish and sort of left the faith herself sort of around the process of writing Disobedience, which is in itself really interesting. But then also this idea of it being like punishment for wanting to dominate, that means that you become lesser, which also seems to sort of directly critique how male dominance is framed. So sort of that kind of double standard towards women, I think, is quite interesting. Sorry, I don't really know what I'm doing with that. I just thought
it's no, I think that's, I mean, it's really interesting. I like, not to go too far down the biblical rabbit hole, but like, one of the things that always stuck out to me, if you read Genesis, you actually find that there are two versions of Genesis, and different things happen in different orders in those two versions. And one of the big differences is that in one of them, man and women are created back to back, and then God passes his hand between them and splits them at the same time they exist, right? Whereas the other one is the very famous Adam goes to sleep, take the rib, create Eve story. And it seems like that's a really important difference in terms of this kind of like visualization of these power dynamics, that like if there are two equals who are connected in that important way, in a yin yang kind of way, that's very different than one of them being made as a part of the other.
Yeah. And then how many other versions didn't even make it in? But sure. So yeah.
Well, yeah, and this gets to this other really wonderful part of this this book, which is the epistemic uncertainty, the like the lack of knowledge that the cataclysm creates, and how that allows for such a beautiful critique of our own current claims and understandings about the distant past. There's so much great send-ups of like evolutionary psych arguments in here, where it's like, oh well, because obviously, like you were saying, they, you know, because women have to protect their children, they would obviously have these powers forever, right? This would never have been otherwise. Is so wonderful.
Although I find it interesting how much happier I am with evolutionary biology when it says things I agree with, which there's some really good writing currently on like female sexuality and stress that's coming from a biological perspective that I think is really functional. And I was super conflicted when I started reading it, because I was like, well, I, you know, spent so long kind of having this massive problem with evolutionary biology, and actually my problem is actually with the way evolutionary biology is currently framed and utilized, rather than the concept of it itself, and when it does things that, you know, on the one hand I believe to be more right, but then on the other hand frankly align with my political beliefs, then I'm much more comfortable with it. And so you kind of have to apply those questions to yourself as well. And I think that's kind of what the power is trying to say, is, you know, question your own assumptions about how you think any of this stuff is framed, as well as critiquing other people's.
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of the things that I wanted to add about the narrator, right? Because for the most part, the Neil character is sort of conveyed as being the most reliable in the sense that he's sort of right on the facts, we think, right? But he has this one comment where he says he doesn't believe that the worst that happened to men during and after the cataclysm could have been happening to women beforehand. Like, he just can't imagine. And he gives an evo-psych argument for why societies would never, you know, kill off fertile women, children, and they would never mess with their genitalia in harmful kinds of ways. Like, it would just be so counterproductive. And I love that moment, because we're just sitting here in the real world going, oh, but they do, right?
Which then comes back to the conversation we were having about, you know, what would a reversal like that prioritized, air quotes, traditionally female values? And are they actually, again, you know, are they essentially female? Are they constructively female? Is it something different because it's like actually coming from a sort of female experience, or is it just different because it's just different?
And yeah, it's just like if you took care ethics and you were like, what if all women suddenly had the power to like heal? Right? Like, they didn't have any more physical power, but suddenly they could raise people from the dead, right? They could cure serious wounds by laying on hands, right? So it sort of exemplifies that nurturing identity that is often associated with women. How different, like, what do y'all think that hypothetical would look like compared to this story?
But then again, what would it look like if men all got the power to heal?
Right.
Does, you can sort of play, and why should, like, I think that's one of the things that the book is also trying to say, is like, why should women, I'm totally reversing on my previous position, but, you know, why should women have to have to heal things? Why can't they
absolutely,
you know, blow things up with electricity? But then also, if you want to be better than the thing you're critiquing, and this is why it's epistemological electroshock therapy, because you just get tied in knots with what the what the thing is, because nothing's real. It's right. All fine.
It's hard because it's both real and it's not real, right? It's we construct it and then make it very, very real. And this is, I think, another fascinating critique about this question of apocalyptic renewal, like the can you get there from here question, is like, are we always just stuck playing out what we have currently learned, and like, unless we totally cut it off right at the end and like blind ourselves to the past, do just new power forms always just reemerge in whatever vacuum currently exists?
Yeah, and sort of how much do you leave in place to start the new thing?
Well, but like, you know, this might be stupid, but like, what if this power was distributed to the same number of people, but just not varied by gender, just random? Like, what would that look like? Like, is it, you know, I mean, right, there would still be this hierarchy, but it would be based around, like, gender might even become less meaningful the way we know it. Like, it might not matter as much. What matters is this divide between who has this power and who's dominant in this way and who isn't.
But isn't that's what Harry Potter's doing? Like, and all the wizards who are like, well, we should be in control.
You're right, I just rewrote Harry Potter. Okay, you're right. Sorry. So that was stupid. Harry Potter.
Part of how I read this critique of the book, though, is that, like, think of the modern world, right? If suddenly women had as much upper body strength as men, right? Setting aside questions of if there are real differences, right? Like, that's the metaphor here, right? I think part of the argument is because the power structures that started with physical differences have shifted into large cultural control, that like that shift in dynamic wouldn't be enough to bring about an egalitarian society. Yeah. That like you'd get the stuff you get in the book of like men still controlling even stronger women or something like that. That like that's where I'm tempted to the apocalyptic renewal idea, that like unless you wipe out all of the calcified structures that have built up around the initial imbalance, can you ever really start for get back to an equality?
I'm with you. Let's have an apocalypse. I think that's a good idea. I'm glad we'll be fine. We're in space. We'll be okay. What I would do, should we talk about before we run out of time, the TV show, the adaptation? I thought there was some stuff offline, Hannah, that you'd said you might be interesting to talk about, because they are doing a TV show on Hulu as well? The same as
I think it might be Amazon, but do not.
Well, either way, they're doing a show. Interesting.
It is going to be really interesting. And so Naomi Alderman's really closely involved in the TV show. And one of the interesting things that came out of this conference I was at, that she was at, did I mention I met Naomi Alderman? Because I'm super cool.
I didn't mention at the beginning of the
We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. We talked about our Jewish mothers. It was wonderful. So she was saying she's really closely involved. And, you know, I think one of the nature of being at a conference with the writer of the person you're talking about is that you maybe don't go as deep into the critiques that you might otherwise go into. But she was quite frank about sort of a lot of the criticism that she's got, particularly around sort of whether the sort of characters like Jocelyn and her boyfriend, who's a boy with a skein, are trying to represent something kind of trans or intersex identity. And she kind of is sort of clear on that, but sort of thinks that she didn't get it quite right. And she was very much talking about using the show as an opportunity to dig into some of the things that she maybe hadn't thought about in as much detail, or to sort of potentially write some rights and wrongs. And I think, I guess it's quite interesting to think about this idea of multiple perspectives from the idea of, I guess, a TV show allowing you to have multiple writers on person's world. And actually, you know, if there might be a critique of the sort of one dimensionality of some of the racial politics at the expense of the gender politics, which would make sense from the focus of the book, because, you know, and that's the problem with this kind of multiple thinking is, like, what do you have time to physically fit in? We can't read in hyperlink yet. Then actually something like a TV show where you can world build much more expansively might actually be the right medium to expand that further. So I think it's going to be really interesting. And then it also struck me that I think what she's done simultaneously is she's created this incredibly compelling narrative, but she's also built a world. Like, it is a kind of, you know, speculative fiction thought experiment. And I was sort of wondering about this, I mean, not to bring back to Harry Potter again, but, like, if you build a world that people want to inhabit, then they want to see themselves included in it. And then people start to ask questions like, well, what does it look like for this type of person if they have the power? And what would it look like for this type of person if they could cast magic in this way? And does an author have a responsibility to represent every single type of being in their world? And how much are they just giving you a world to play with? And I don't really know the answer, but I think sometimes there's a lot of pressure to put on authors to have all of the answers for these worlds they've constructed.
Yeah.
How you end up with J.K.
It's hard to,
you know, this is how wizards magic away their whatever.
Yeah, it's hard to, like, put that expectation, that burden on one person to be able to come up with every single, you know, like, every single perspective in a world. But at the same time, as an author, if you ignore somebody, if you leave somebody out, it's kind of telling who you maybe leave out of your world that you've created. That's a tough problem.
I'm on board for the most part. I think there's been a couple of shows that have followed this track of coming from material that I love, but has some challenges, like Preacher and American Gods. And the work that's being done, I think, to sort of modernize this material, if we see that same kind of work here, I'd be really excited to see how that goes. And I think it's going to be incredibly hard to watch.
Yeah, as long as it's not entirely in slow motion like Handmaid's Tale, I'll be happy.
Yes. No more than 30% slow motion.
Yeah.
I don't remember the slow motion The Handmaid's Tale, but I'll take your word. Yeah.
Non-stop. I've watched it all, and it's, yeah. Anyway, just poking fun at it. It can be, you want something to happen in the show, and then it's like 10 minutes of slow music and slow motion while we look really close at what's-her-name's face, and then that's the whole episode. So, yeah. Don't do that. That's my advice.
The man critiquing The Handmaid's Tale.
Oh!
That's not allowed under the rules of the new society. Mm.
You better zap me.
Yep.
Zap me now. I accept my punishment. I'll be one of those, you know, like one of those people burned at the stake for saying the Bible's something different back in the day. I'll be that person.
Okay.
Yes. Too much slow motion. I'm willing to die for this belief.
You could be in the men's studies department. It's fine. You can have your opposing positions.
What if I would do some research and find out a man was actually in charge of the slow motion part? Can I, like, he edited it maybe? Like, can then it'll be okay? Is that identity politics? That
we'll take it under review. The Inquisition will hear your plea.
I mean, what do you think our takeaways then should be, given all this epistemic uncertainty and all these, like, because this is, I think, one challenge that some folks, I think, raise with postmodernist critiques, right? Like, at the end of the day, what actionable information can we draw from any of this with regard to our current situation, its historical contexts? Like, what should we infer?
I mean, I think it's funny. I had a friend who sort of discovered postmodernism recently, and he came to me in crisis and was just like, how do you live? Nothing is real. My job doesn't make sense anymore. And it's just like, oh, bless. But, and, you know, I think the way that I like to think through it is that sort of once you accept everything's an ideology, you just have to pick the one that works best for you. And, you know, that's essentially why I'm a feminist, because, you know, I don't necessarily think any society is more true than another, but I know which one I'd want to live in. So that's the one I'd want to work to construct. And I think what the power kind of does on a certain level is give you, it gives you the options to sort of see what it's like. It sort of goes like, here's this kind of visceral identification with this kind of violence. You get to feel what it's like to take that kind of revenge that you might have imagined, but you also get to see the consequences of it simultaneously. So the decisions that you then make about, you know, what kind of political space you want to occupy, like where you might want to put your stress, can be made having thought through more than just, oh, that doesn't sound like it's for me, or like, oh, I think people are making, you know, bold statements about what women suffer. Like, you know, the more knowledge you have, the, I guess, the more fragile your decisions might seem, but you also know why you're committing to them. I don't know, that's how I deal with being a postmodernist. I think people do it differently, but
I think that's well said. That's a good way. I think that'll be a good way to end this one, since we're running out of time. So don't worry, you can take something out of things, even though things don't mean things. Is that what we're? Do I have you right? I'm just making sure.
Yes, that's it. It's really easy. I don't know what people are so stressed.
Yeah.
Philosophy. That's just philosophy. It's just the thing.
All right. Well, we are unfortunately out of time. That was a lot of fun. And of course, another big thanks to you, Hannah, for joining us and only zapping us a few times. It was painful. We edited it out, but it was, you know
I deserved it.
I think we can all agree you deserved it.
Yeah, no, that's, no, of course. Yeah, absolutely. That wasn't the question. Yeah, no, thanks for joining us. It was a lot of fun. We are going to get hang on to you for one more After Dark. But on the main segment here, just wanted to say this was great. I learned so much, and I really appreciate you coming on.
Well, thank you for having me.
And there's nothing you want to plug. There's nothing you want to, no place people should follow you, anything. You're just...
Oh, I mean...
Twitter handle.
Even your,
yeah. Oh, gosh, my Twitter handle's so lame. Like, it's just not even... It's like... because it came off like my Neopets name when I was a kid. And then I just used that for my handles before I... So, yeah. But it's... My Twitter's really lame. I don't know. At some point, the conference that I was at is going to publish a book of essays about Naomi Alderman. I think it's called, like... Glyph Publishing, maybe. So there will be a book at some point.
Almost something to plug. Okay, we'll do it. Maybe we'll catch up with you when it comes out, and you know,
find out. The show.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. Either way, so everybody, go follow your fake Twitter handle that you didn't give out. And we also have to tease next week. We'll be doing some Q&A. I'm so excited to get back to that. That is really one of my favorite things to do, because our listeners and patrons have so many fun questions. So that'll be fun. What do you think, Aaron?
Yeah, I'll get a poll up or a list up for people to start asking questions on the Patreon. And I will warn people well in advance so that you can all change your names, and we'll try to get through all the names as per usual. So looking forward to it.
That's right.
We would like to thank our 25-tier patrons. In Space, No One Can. Here, Use Cream. What Do You Mean, Mueller? I Barely Even Knew Her. Corey Ebert. Winchesters Never Die. Hey Thomas, explain this Patreon name. And Alex Arnett, thank you all very much. And double special extra bonus high utility thanks to our $50 top tier Definitely Not a Clone patrons, Philip Gatt, Jonathan Steele is a great dad fund, half the patrons agree Eli Bosnick should change his Patreon name, and my cult leader could beat up your cult leader, which is true. Thank you all very much.
Good times. All right. Well, with that said, thanks so much for listening, everybody. And patrons, we will see you after dark here, where I'm going to see if we can talk about some of the sex scenes in the book. I think that would be
good... want to talk about the sex scenes. Great.
Yeah. Right. Okay, good. Well, that'll be a good teaser content. After dark, jump on patreon.com/0G and go check us out. Otherwise, we'll see you next week.
That's all for the main show, but if you'd like to go to patreon.com/0G, you can enjoy Philosophers in Space After Dark. Here's a little sneak peek for you.
No, you kept assuming that just because Hannah was zapping me that I wasn't enjoying it, and I kept wanting to correct it, but I just couldn't fit it into the main segment. I mean, I don't know if I have a thing about electricity. This book was so visceral for me. Like, I was writhing around physically trying to read these descriptions, both the positive and the negative. It was very... That's a polarity joke, right? That works.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring forth fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/zeroG. You can find us on Twitter at zeroG Philosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.